The Guardian.
It's polling day and we're celebrating with a special Election Daily Nerdfest.
We've got a record number of guests on the podcast today. We're bringing you tips from our reporters around the country on the key seats to watch out for tonight as you sit in front of the TV till the wee hours.
Remember, sleep is for the weak.
I'm Zoe Williams.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland. Owen Jones has abandoned us for a Get Out the Vote bike ride.
And don't forget to cast your vote today.
So let's get right to it. First up, we're joined on the line by Deborah Mattinson, the director of Britain Thinks. She's been carrying out focus groups for us across the country. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, hello.
Deborah, it's been an intense few weeks. It feels like a lot's happened since this election was called. What have you been seeing in the focus groups? Has anything actually changed for the voters?
Well, you know, one thing, as you were doing your introduction, this flashed through my mind. The first thing to say, and the thing that always strikes me, but you do have to keep reminding yourself of this, is that normal people are not nerds like the rest of us.
And it's heartbreaking news to tell us that now, after all these weeks.
I know. But one of the things that is so striking when you look at all the work from the voter panels that we've had in six different constituencies is just actually how little people are taking notice of all of this. I got very excited after the first debate and went online to see what people were posting. Answer, nothing.
Does that mean, Deborah, that all the things that we've been reporting on a lot, you know, Theresa May appearing to sort of crater on the dementia tax, or, for example, the non-appearance at debates, Jeremy Corbyn doing really quite well on TV appearances, has none of that cut through?
No, actually, that's not quite right, because obviously some things have cut through, and people do think, actually, that this is an important election. It might be a boring and uninteresting one, but it's also important. One of the things that's really unusual about this election is that, from the public's point of view, people didn't know very much about either of the two main party leaders at the beginning of the campaign. So they went into the election with a very kind of impressionistic sense. They thought Theresa May was marvellous because they didn't know anything about her. She was a Tory woman, therefore they thought she was going to be just like Mrs. Thatcher, which in their hazy recollection is kind of great. And Jeremy Corbyn, again, just very impressionistic. They thought he was a bit of a dork. Now, both of those views have changed, and that's probably the one thing that's changed most significantly and the thing that I think most accounts for the narrowing of the gap between the polls.
And do you think, with the Corbyn thing, because you see these kind of huge enthusiastic crowds, you saw the Libertines gig, but is that still a completely niche position? Do people... Does a regular person have any enthusiasm for him?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sobering thing to remember is that the last Labour leader who did that so successfully was Michael Foot.
You mean giant rallies in that
giant rallies,
campaign.
And you know, and
I can't believe he would have got a Libertines gig out, Michael.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true. But I mean, he did. You know, he did do those big rallies a lot in 1983, and it didn't actually help him very much. And the truth is, it obviously will make Jeremy and the team feel fantastic, and that's not a bad thing in itself. And certainly, he's been looking like he's been enjoying this. He's got into his stride. He makes other politicians look, well, a bit like politicians, and that's not a good thing. That's not a good look. We saw that in the Labour leadership contest. We've seen it just now. But yes, it's not very persuasive.
And the question is, in a way, building what Zoe was asking, is whether that enthusiasm, that energy works beyond the Labour tribe. Does it actually win over any voters? And it was really interesting you were saying they both, in a way, began a sort of blank slate, that she seemed sort of Thatcherish, he seemed, you said, a dork. The fact that people have changed their views, has that in any way shifted votes?
Well, I think it has shifted votes a bit. I mean, you know, let's not forget, we started this campaign just imagining how big the landslide was going to be. And, you know, whilst my own view, and put it out there now, I think that there will be a fairly comfortable Tory majority. And I don't see much to suggest that won't be what happens.
And have you been right before, Deborah, that's really interesting you've just said that, but are you one of those people who has been right before? So should we take seriously what you're saying? Did you get 2015 right and 2010 right?
My company does not do that sort of big polling, so
just
your gut. I've got nothing to lose here.
But in your kitchen, at your kitchen table, are you normally right?
Yes, I think so, yes. And I trust small data as well, you know, and what I'm getting from the focus groups, actually matches what people are getting on the ground in some of those marginal constituencies, the ones that we'll be looking out for tonight as they start to come in, where I'm hearing from people, I'm hearing particularly from those seats in the Midlands and the North, particularly the ones where the UKIP vote is bigger than the Labour majority, I'm hearing Labour people.
And just tell us, what are your three seats to watch out for tonight?
Well, Nuneaton, I think, is going to be my number one. That's where I shall be reaching sort of fever pitch excitement. That was the first marginal to declare in 2015. And it was the moment, apparently, where David Cameron knew that he'd won. Because, you know, it showed a 3% swing to the Tories. And at that point, he said, that's it. You know, actually, it showed that the exit poll was understating the Tory vote. Because if you recall, the exit poll predicted a hung parliament, which in itself was a surprise to many. And in fact, obviously, there was, you know, a Tory majority. So I think Nuneaton. I'll be looking out for Darlington, partly because I was born there. But also, that's another of those very interesting seats where the UKIP vote is significantly bigger than the Labour majority. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens there. And Birmingham Erdington, it's one of the seats that we've been looking at with The Guardian, where, you know, it's a Midlands marginal, Jack Dromey is the MP, and, you know, again, we'll be looking to see, we've been getting some quite negative stuff back, you know, for him from The Guardian project. I think voters, you know, many of whom have been lifelong Labour voters are saying this time no.
And it's an important one as well, because Nick Timothy, that close aide to
Theresa
May,
exactly.
He comes from there and talks of Erdington conservatism as if that's that new strand of Toryism aiming at reaching the working class.
Exactly. I mean, I was thinking about Nick Timothy, though, that his reputation has probably taken the biggest hit after Theresa May's following this campaign.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. Actually, he apparently is the architect of that social care manifesto pledge. And when we totted up the policies that people mention in our panels, that came top. That was the thing that people noticed most. And it wasn't the social care policy itself, it was the U-turn.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for that, Deborah Mattinson. She'll be watching through the night, and so will we. OK, to Edinburgh and our Scotland editor, Severin Carell. Sev, the SNP won all but three of the seats that were up for grabs last time, but what should we be looking out for this time?
Well, we know that the SNP are going to lose seats. The real question is how many. It could be as few as five or six. It could be as many, if it's have a really bad night, of 12 or 15. Now, the three seats that you could look out for, which will be the real test of how significant the SNP defeats are going to be, would be Perth and North Perthshire, which is one of the longest-held SNP seats in Scotland. They've held it since 1995. And the Tory MEP, Ian Duncan, is hoping to unseat Pete Wishart, who is the chairman of the Scottish Affairs Select Committee. Now, if Ian Duncan beats Pete Wishart in Perth and North Perthshire, that will show that the Tory tide is actually reaching pretty high. And that would also include Murray. Now, Murray is held by the Scottish National Party's Westminster leader, and he's also the deputy leader of the party in Angus Robertson. And Angus Robertson is, without doubt, one of the biggest beasts in the Scottish political jungle. And if the Tories succeeded in beating him in Murray, that would be a really strong evidence that the pro-Brexit vote is damaging the SNP, as is the anti-independence vote, which is actually mobilising Tory and, to a great degree, Labour and Lib Dem voters all around Scotland. And the other test seat would be East Renfrewshire. Now, East Renfrewshire is a fascinating battle. It's a genuine three-way fight between the SNP, who won it from the former Scottish Labour leader Jim Murphy quite famously in 2015, and the Tories, who are hoping to regain it. It was, until Jim Murphy won it in 1997, a safe, really deep blue Tory part of Scotland, and then Labour hoping to regain it. Blair MacDougall, who was the head and chief of the Better Together pro-UK anti-independence campaign, is hoping to regain it. And he was actually working for Jim Murphy when Jim Murphy was an MP there.
Are Brexit and independence the only things that are turning people away from the SNP? Or are there kind of more structural problems with the past? Because it's only 2 years since their landslide, so it's strange that they should have kind of built an opposition to them.
Well, this is a very, very valid question. There are two non-constitutional trends which are emerging in Scotland. The first one is the SNP is now being damaged by anxieties and criticisms and unhappiness about its domestic record. Nicola Sturgeon, when she's in live TV debates, has been constantly attacked by teachers and nurses in particular about the quality of Scotland's schools or problems in the health service. So that's undoubtedly biting, it's undoubtedly hurting. There are also problems, actually, on that account with Nicola Sturgeon's own popularity. There was a recent Ipsos Mori popularity rating for STV, which showed that Nicola Sturgeon's person popularity had fallen 28 points since September last year. She's now at -4, and she had the worst popularity rating of all the Scottish Party leaders. Now, it should be said that Nicola Sturgeon is known to pretty much the entire population, and there are some Scottish Party leaders that are only known to two-thirds of them, so that's quite important. And the second thing which has happened over the last couple of weeks is, in common with the rest of the United Kingdom, Labour's vote has actually gone up, and we all think it's to do with the Corbyn surge. And so Corbyn's appeal, and particularly his domestic agenda, because he gets completely tangled up in Scotland's constitutional future, is all about the left-wing Labour revival. And that is undoubtedly bringing people away from the SNP, and particularly young voters. And that could actually make a considerable difference in some constituencies. We're certainly going to see SNP majorities being trimmed or slashed or even almost entirely gone in many seats in Scotland, even if they hold on to most.
Sev Carell, thank you very much.
Right, now on to our colleague in Northern Ireland, Henry MacDonald. What are your tips for the seats to watch in the hours ahead?
I think the key tip to watch is Fermanagh South Tyrone, which I wrote about in The Guardian today. That's the border constituency, one of the most westernly constituencies of the whole of the UK. It currently is held by the Ulster Unionist MP, Tom Elliott, but he's facing a strong challenge from Sinn Féin's Michelle Gildernew. It's going to be very, very tight. It was only a couple of hundred votes the last time. And in fact, when Gildernew first held the seat, the election before last, he won by something like 8 votes. So the margins are very, very tight. It's the one to watch, I think.
What time do you think that will come in? Sorry.
I think that could probably be, that could be a late one. You could even be subject to a recount. That'll be one of the later results.
Right.
I think we'll get, There's a possibility of a tight contest in North Belfast between Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionists. Possibly, John Finucane, who's the son of the murdered Belfast solicitor Pat Finucane, standing for Sinn Féin. He'll mount a strong challenge. I expect Nigel Dodds, the sitting DUP MP, to win. Could be an interesting contest in East Belfast. The DUP hold that seat as well. Gavin Robinson, he's under stiff challenge from the leader of the Cross Community Alliance Party, Naomi Long. She's quite popular. Again, I suspect the DUP will hold that seat. The tightest of all will be Fermanagh South Tyrone, the one to watch. It always is. It's a cockpit constituency all the way back to 1981 when Bobby Sands, the IRA hunger striker, won that seat.
When it became famous. Henry, exactly. The overall UK story seems to be, in most places, obviously not in Scotland, not in Northern Ireland, but a return to two-party politics, and two parties being Labour and Conservative elsewhere in the UK. But is Northern Ireland now increasingly a two-party story with the DUP and Sinn Féin?
Yes, indeed. I mean, they're the two dominant forces. And look, I was speaking to an Irish government official yesterday on the eve of poll, and he pointed out, the contest really in the general election here isn't as important as the other show in town, which is the talks, which will resume on Monday morning, aimed at restoring power share principally between the DUP and Sinn Féin. Those talks are going to kick off once all the fallout from the national contest is sorted out over the weekend. We're back into real basic stuff at Stormont with the two main parties and the other couple of parties as well to try and form another power sharing coalition under a devolved institution. It's a much more important development in many ways than the actual outcome of the 18 seats here.
Our thanks to Henry MacDonald. Now, just a little reminder, by the way, to subscribe to Election Daily wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be picking apart the results tomorrow, and Owen and I will be sticking around next week for a special crossover show with our regular Politics Weekly podcast. Now, London has long been a Labour city. John McDonnell, Diane Abbott, Emily Thornberry and Jeremy Corbyn were all representatives of London seats going into this election. So could the party extend its dominance of the capital tonight? And what about the Lib Dems? We haven't talked about them much in this campaign. Our deputy political editor, Rowena Mason, is on the line joining us now. Rowena, very cruelly, we're asking people to name the three seats they think are the ones to watch. And I know there's lots of different stories to tell in London, but what are the three that have caught your eye?
It's very tricky because I think there's going to be a lot of volatility in London, potentially. There is, as you say, a real chance for Labour to do very well in London. It's a city where they've currently got 45 seats and the Tories have only got 26 and Libs have two. So there is potential for them to take some seats, unlike some other areas of the country. So if I was going to name my top Labour target seat in London, I would say Croydon Central. And they're absolutely desperate to get that one. It's a real marginal. The Tory MP there is Gavin Barwell. And there's been a lot of Labour activity focusing on that seat. There are a couple of other Tories they want to take out in Harrow East and Hendon as well. But I would say Croydon Central is probably their best bet. And then if we go on to some of the ones, I mean, there are a lot of seats in sort of outer London that the Conservatives have got their eye on. And probably one to watch it would be Brentford, if I had to go for any of them, because that previously had a Tory MP, Mary McLeod, and then she was displaced at the last election. So that will be number one on the Conservatives' hit list for seats that they want to get back. Similarly, there's one in Ealing as well that used to be a Tory seat, but that's Labour's probably got more chance of hanging on to that because in that seat, Rupert Hough's seat, the Green Party has stood aside for her. That's a real test of whether this theory of the Progressive Alliance could actually work if she does well and hangs on to her seat.
Didn't Vince Cable also say that she was so closely aligned to him in views that all Lib Dems should campaign for her?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of the progressive left getting behind her. So I think, you know, that will definitely be one to have a look out for during the night.
And what are you excited about? What would a result that kind of stun you?
A result that stuns me would be the Conservatives managing to take a lot of extra seats in London. I mean, it doesn't feel like that's going to happen, but there have been a lot of Conservative campaigning activity in Leave voting seats, such as Dagenham and Raynham, which has historically been a very strong Labour seat, John Cruddas's seat. It's quite a working class seat, and the Conservatives think that because of their position on Brexit that they might be in with a chance there. So that would be a sort of shock upset result. But there's another one actually that could be very interesting. If we look a little bit at the Lib Dems, they only have two seats in London, which is quite a change from their strength there in the past, particularly in some of the suburbs. But their top target seats in London, one of them is Twickenham, which is where Vince Cable was the MP for absolutely ages. And he was a big scalp in the 2015 election. He got booted out by Tania Matthias, who's a sort of Remainy, quite liberal Tory. And the Liberal Democrats are absolutely desperate to get that seat back. And that could be quite significant in terms of Vince Cable potentially being a leadership contender if Tim Farron does very badly and ends up resigning.
Now, some of the most interesting results tonight could come in Wales, where the Tories are hoping to win MPs in mining towns that would once have been unthinkable as swing seats. Stephen Morris joins us now. Stephen, what are you seeing?
The picture could be a very interesting one. At the start of the campaign, it was looking really rocky for Labour. We had some polls come out that suggested they could have their worst results since, well, for about a century, and the Tories could get their best results since the 19th century. Now, since then, it's changed a little bit, and Labour's fought back quite well. And Labour might do okay in the end, I think.
I mean, can you tell us which seats you'll be watching?
Yeah, up in the north, for example, I'll be looking out for Ynys Môn, which is the island of Anglesey. That's a three-way marginal, Labour, Plaid, and the Tories. It's held by Labour at the moment. The Plaid's not very far behind. And the Tories might do okay there as well. I was up there not so long ago, and I was hearing all sorts of things from different voters who normally vote Tory, saying they're going to vote Plaid, and vice versa. So it's kind of all over the place there, I think. Another interesting one up north is the Vale of Clwyd. Now, Jeremy Corbyn was not far away from there yesterday. He was in Colwyn Bay. You may have seen the pictures of him on the beach with a big crowd behind him there.
He seemed to be quite popular up there, but maybe that's just a bit.
No, he did seem very popular, didn't he? I was seeing tweets from people saying, I didn't know so many people lived in Colwyn Bay that were on the beach there that day. And I saw a tweet from a student saying, I can't focus on my exams. I'm so excited about Jeremy Corbyn being here. But Labour lost that last time. The Tories took it, 237 majority there. And Labour's working very hard to win that one back, obviously.
And when do you expect declarations for those ones?
Oh, I think kind of 2, 3, 4 in the morning. You can never tell with these ones. Cardiff North's one to watch as well. That tends to be a little bit later. That's maybe 5 o'clock in the morning. that's a big, a classic bellwether seat, really. Tories and Labour going hammer and tooth there. Corbyn was there as well at the very start of the election. So that's one Labour's fought back in and might take back there as well.
Because with the other two seats, you gave us more of a sense of why they're interesting. With Cardiff North, besides being a marginal, I'm just wondering if you should just give us a line of what kind of seat it is in terms of suburban, industrial, student, yeah, whatever it is.
Absolutely. Cardiff North is it's the sort of seat where you'd think Labour would do very well. Lots of public service workers there. It's the old seat of Julie Morgan, the wife of the late Rodri Morgan, who very sadly died during this campaign. And Julie still holds the assembly seat there. So it's a kind of Labour area, but over the past few years, the Tories have done quite well there.
Well, thanks to Stephen Morris. Now, loyal Guardian readers have probably spotted our Voices and Vote series, where we've been sending reporters out to spend time in a number of constituencies, getting to know the people there and also the candidates. And one of those reporters is Josh Halliday, who stationed himself in Hartlepool, where Labour's position has been said to be pretty precarious. UKIP came a close second there. So all eyes now on Hartlepool. Josh, what's the mood there? What are you expecting?
I think it's going to be a very, very difficult night for UKIP in Hartlepool. It's been a very, very low-key campaign. They've had no high-profile visits for the past 6 weeks. The last one was when Paul Nuttall came to town, and it was marred and overshadowed by two women fighting outside a pub, which captured all national headlines. The party in Hartlepool has been beset by fighting, in-party fighting. There's been controversy after controversy. One councillor has been prosecuted for drink driving. Another has made controversial remarks about Islam just in the past week. And the candidate, Phil Broughton, who, as you say, did very, very well in 2015, he's sort of been left to fight this campaign single-handedly, really, with little support from the National Party. So I think they're in for a very, very difficult night, and it'll be crucial where those votes go.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Do you think they are going to? Do you think there's a possibility those votes just won't turn out?
I think there's a real possibility that they won't turn out. From what I've heard talking to people in both Labour, Tory, and UKIP, they're sort of evenly split between Labour and Tory. They're going to both parties. Some are reverting back to Labour, having been lifetime Labour voters and just not being able to bring themselves to vote Tory. For others, UKIP's been a sort of gateway to the Conservative Party, and they'll have no qualms with voting Tory this time because they are being seen as a party that's dragging Britain out of the European Union, which is obviously a very, very a key issue in Hartlepool.
And so is your gut that Labour hold on to that seat?
Yeah, just I think it's going to be very, very close. I think it could go down to a recount. I think it's going to be a very tight marginal between Labour and the Tories. But I think if UKIP's vote stays, you know, even slightly solid, they lose just a few thousand votes, then that will be enough to cannibalise the sort of anti-Labour vote and give Labour a bit of an uneasy route to victory.
Thanks, Josh. Before we go, we better pick our own seats to watch. What are yours?
Well, there's so many, and we've heard them from all our brilliant colleagues around the country. So I'm just going to pick one extra one, which is Morley and Outwood, which was a big sort of almost totemic seat in 2015 because in the early hours, well, in fact, almost 8 o'clock in the morning, after multiple recounts, Ed Balls lost his seat there and so changed the future of light entertainment TV thereafter. But it's an interesting seat because the reason why he lost was the UKIP vote went over in big numbers to the Tories. So tonight, what I'll be looking out for is, do the Tories build on and expand that majority? They got, you know, one by whisker. Do they now win it quite big? Because that will tell you if there is that trend in the north of England, particularly for UKIP voters to decamp properly to the Tories. So I'll be watching that. And the other thing, the reason why I will, is that a couple of Labour organisers and candidates have said to me, you know, Corbyn's doing so well in the cities and among sort of students and all that, but actually the election will be decided by dozens of Morley and Outwoods, these sort of market towns, often on the edges of cities, often with a history of mining, and those places are quietly immune from the sort of Corbyn surge and will be quietly going conservative. So Morley and Outwood is just a good little indicator, I think.
My ones to watch, my own constituency, Vauxhall, is really fascinating because nobody can stand Kate Hoey. You know, it's like die-hard Labour voters, of whom I am one, I just really find it hard to even think of voting for her when she's been so close to Nigel Farage over the Brexit thing, when she's pro fox hunting, for goodness sake. She's a really, really, really problematic candidate. And I'm genuinely thinking of voting Lib Dem for the first time in my life, which is saying something. I'm also very interested in all those kind of Progressive Alliance seats. So the NHA seat, Southwest Surrey, all the kind of Brighton Pavilion, Brighton Kemptown, Hove, Lewis, those seats where either non-aggression pacts or actual pacts were made. I'd be fascinated to see what happens there.
You talked about them as the Rebel Alliance, this being the sort of Star Wars election. So we
I don't know whether we ever quite got our Darth Vader-iness to get it together, but you know.
Now, before we go, a last bit of campaign reading from us both. Zoe, what's taken your fancy today?
Well, I know we're not meant to plug our own colleagues shamelessly, but Marina Hyde is so funny that I was in KFC laughing my head off. I think I actually swung round some teenagers to start reading The Guardian. It's really, really, really good. Read it and it will cheer you up, even though it won't.
And I'm going to recommend something because by way of diversionary tactics on election day, I think once the election's done, the campaigning's over, all we're waiting for now really is results. So I'm going to recommend something unrelated to the election. For political obsessives, there is a fantastic bit of distraction today in the form of high drama in Washington, because today is Comey Day, they're calling it, where Jim Comey, the sacked former director of the FBI, is testifying from 3 p.m. UK time on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, and expected to spill the beans on Donald Trump. So you can read countless backgrounders in The Guardian or The New York Times, all kinds of places, about his written testimony, which if you just want something to read, it's amazing because he's written it almost like a novelist, talking about the awkwardness of these dinners he had with Trump, where he went out of his way to hold his facial expression so he didn't seem to be agreeing with Trump when Trump said, I want you to back off on this investigation. So Comey's written this gripping testimony. You can read that now. And then if you feel like something that isn't the election, you can put on the TV at 3 p.m. onwards and watch him testify. Now, that is it for today. Follow us on Twitter at Guardian Audio. I'm at Friedland and Zoe is at Zoe SQ Williams.
Make sure you fire up the Guardian's election live blog, which will now run through the night with news and analysis from all our reporters at counts all around the country.
Now, we are back tomorrow. By then, we will know what's happened. Our thanks to Zoe for filling in for Owen and all our guests today. Make sure you go and vote. You don't need a polling card. And as long as you're in the queue by 10 p.m., you will be able to cast your vote. The producers have been the brilliant Phil Maynard and terrific Gabriella Jones. We thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.